Welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast. Today, I'm speaking to sleep expert and owner of Sleep for Performance, Ian Dunican. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast. So today I'm delighted to bring Ian Dunican on the show for this episode. So one thing that frustrates me a little bit about the information that's on sleep and how I kind of take that information in and practice it is, well, I don't. And I'm guessing that there's plenty of athletes and plenty of coaches out there that don't. So people know that you shouldn't be using phones to read before bed, or shouldn't be on social media while you're in bed, or a certain amount of time before that. But I'm still doing it, and I'm guessing coaches are still doing it, and athletes are still doing it. So one thing I didn't want to do in this episode was to go over old ground. And one thing that me and Ian discussed a lot in this episode, which I think is absolutely vital, is biomathematical modelling to predict sleep from long journeys and from overseas travel. So I think this topic is something that hasn't been discussed on other podcasts and other episodes when it comes to sleep. So there's definitely tons to take away, apart from the obvious don't be on your phone before you go to bed kind of advice. So I'm really hoping that you kind of get loads from this episode, because I did with a long journey coming up. So also in this episode is a big chunk of the time discussing caffeine, and not caffeine in terms of performance, but what happens after the performance and how that actually affects sleep, as well as a little bit of time discussing sleep disorders. But I think the real gold in this is definitely the biomathematical modeling, which I hope you get tons out of, and Ian is an absolute expert when it comes to that. But just before we do get into this episode, I want to say a big thanks to Vald Performance for sponsoring this episode today. So if you haven't heard of Vald Performance, they are the guys behind the Nord Board, the Groin Bar, and the all-new Human Track. So if you haven't heard of either of them three products, visit valdperformance.com or follow them on Twitter at Vald Performance. So their all-new Human Track system is a motion capture system which integrates the Xbox Kinect and four IMUs worn on both wrists and both ankles. So Human Track has been initially validated against the gold standard in Vicon with some really positive initial results, with some more to come, which will be openly available via the Vald Performance website when they do become available. So if you, like I said, if you are interested in getting to know about any of them three products, visit valdperformance.com or follow them on Twitter at valdperformance. Also sponsoring this episode today is ForceDex. So big thanks to ForceDex for their continued support of the podcast. And if you are looking for a force plate hardware and software solution, visit forcedex.com, but also have a little look at episode 139 of the Pacey Performance Podcast. So that's at strengthofscience.com/139, where co-owner of ForceDex, Dr. Daniel Cohen, goes into a lot of detail with regards to all aspects of jump monitoring. It's certainly not a sales pitch for ForceDex, but you can get a real understanding of the capability and ease of use of ForceDex with regards to the software. So if you are interested, ForceDex.com is their website, and follow them on Twitter at ForceDex. So without further ado, over to the episode with Ian. Hope you enjoy, and I'll speak to you soon. Ian Dunican, welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast. Thank you for giving up your time to be here.
No worries. Thanks very much for having me, Rob.
No, it's a pleasure, mate. So anyone who doesn't know who you are, I just want to give us a little bit of a background on yourself, education, background, what you're currently doing, etc.
Yeah, no problem, mate. So as you said, my name is Ian Dunican. Obviously from my accent, born and raised in Ireland. Initially, I joined the military when I left school. We went into infantry, spent about 5 years there. And then I decided to go back to university when I left the military. And I did so here in Western Australia, where I'm currently based, because I'm married to an Australian woman. And so I live here in Perth in Western Australia. I did an undergraduate degree in sort of education. Well, not sort of education, around adult education. I did an associate degree, advanced diploma in health and safety. Postgraduate qualifications, I did a master's in business, a master's in mining engineering, and a graduate certificate in sleep science. And then recently, as I said, I just finished my PhD in sleep and performance in elite combat and contact athletes. In terms of career, because people probably listen to us qualifications and go, that guy's a bit odd. In terms of career, I've worked obviously in military and then in the mining industry, where I really was focused on human performance around things like sleep, fatigue, wellness, but more importantly, the integration or the connectivity with productivity and mining and cost, hence the kind of heavy stuff on the business and the engineering. And a few years ago, I worked for a leading mining company as their global advisor doing that work. So I traveled the world to different countries such as Canada, Mozambique, South Africa, Southeast Asia, helping operations to basically optimize the working hours to enable productivity and lower costs as well. And lastly, my last few years on my PhD was focused on combat and contact athletes, where I worked with the Western Force, who used to be part of the Super Rugby franchise, unfortunately now have gone. And I also worked with the Australian Institute of Sport with their combat sports centre, which is like judo, boxing, wrestling and so on.
Nice. So that productivity in the mining stuff, was that to do with sleep, or was that to do with all aspects of their lifestyle while they're working?
Well, what we were really interested in looking at for some of those projects in mining was, can we design the rosters using tools like biomathematical modeling to basically get a good balance between day shifts and night shifts? Because these operations are 24/7 in remote areas. So a lot of times you have to fly people in and then fly them out to the wind for 2 or 3 weeks and then come out. So how can we kind of optimize the rest work cycle whilst they're here? And can we make them obviously be productive themselves in terms of being alert throughout the 12-hour shift that they will be on for? And obviously we don't want to impact their short-term acute or long-term chronic health. And we want to have them operate in a safe manner whilst they're there. And then importantly as well to that is, are we having enough people scheduled on to basically have that operation running 24/7 and having it running smoothly? Because in these operations, there's a link between kind of how we basically blow up the ground, drill and blast, and then how we move that dirt, load and haul into a plant or a processing, and then how we kind of get it to the port, so how we transport it. So it's very much like kind of manufacturing or a big logistics chain. That kind of system needs to be constantly charged, manned, and enabled. So, you know, it's very, very similar to those other industries. So we constantly have to have people kind of alert in a safe manner to enable safe and efficient production. And if we don't have that, then we start having things like incident accidents, and that obviously leads to downtime on top of even personal harm to somebody, which then leads to loss of productivity. And then when we have to kind of get back from those incidents, we have to increase costs. And sometimes when we have an incident with a big truck in these mining operations, it may cost, you know, between $2 and $3 million to actually fix that, never mind how much money we've lost in productivity.
Mm-hmm. So we might as well chat about biomathematical models as we're here. Just want to talk to us what actually that is, and obviously to go into a little bit of detail on what the kind of differences are amongst the couple that are out there, and how they could, well, we'll move on to how they can potentially relate to, or do relate to, what we do in the kind of sporting context as well.
Yeah, I'm going to start with a statement, Rob, on biomathematical modeling, which might perk people's ears up. I think this may be the biggest or the most untapped quick win that people can use in elite and highly trained sports performance in the world at the moment that people are not looking at. So in saying that, biomathematical modeling, bio and mathematics, biology and mathematics, it kind of combines, was kind of initially developed around military and high-risk industry. And it was in the early 80s where a paper came out by Borbély and his crew. And they basically have this underlying two processes that happen in biomathematical modeling. And they're called the S and the C curve. S standing for sleep and C standing for circadian. And many people will be familiar with circadian, circa meaning about, DM meaning the day, a circadian rhythm, which is about 24.1 or 2 hours over the course of a, over a day, so circadian rhythm. And so these models would have sleep and circadian rhythms in the back of it. And what it allows you to do is a biomathematical model allows you to input things like the amount of sleep that someone's had in the last 24 hours, 48, 72 hours, and so on. It allows you then to look at the time of day, and basically allows you to predict or quantify performance at a specific time. Now, that's at the base level. As things progressed then in the research, and then it was used more in military, and it was also used in aviation, and obviously a high-risk industry as well, a third part came along, which led to the three-process model, which is sleep, circadian process, and then we have also the W, or the wake inertia. And so sleep wake inertia would be different at different types of the day. The easiest way to equate this, or what people would be cognizant of, is if you wake up at, let's say, 4:30 in the morning and you need to drive to the airport, or you got to go training very early and you feel really groggy for about 30 minutes, 45 minutes, that's what we call sleep inertia. Or if you have a nap in the middle of the day and you wake up and you're feeling kind of groggy. And so the model now allows that. So biomathematical modeling has advanced, and there's a number of those models available. The model that I use is what's called SAFETY, which is the Safety Alertness Fatigue Task Effectiveness Simulator, which allows you to put in a range of different variables to either retrospectively look back and analyze the risk or the effectiveness. So you could actually use it retrospectively and look back at a season or a game and plug in the times of the game, the times you trained, the times you slept, the times you woke, the actual geographical location, the flights and so on. You can also do it presently as well. And you can also do it predictively. So you could sit at the start of the season, input the Super Rugby season as we did with the Western Force last year, looked at where we were going to be at risk in terms of lower levels of effectiveness, and then what kind of strategies we may be able to do to increase our effectiveness, rerun the model and see how that actually played out.
So how do you get hold of this? Is this a copyrighted thing that's associated with one company, or is this a model that you can get your hands on and people can run through it? How does it work?
Yeah, so good question. The models are kind of complex to use, and you can buy licenses for the models, which range, I think, between sort of $4,000 to $10,000, and there's a few of them around. And the SAFETY one I use, I think, is personally the most user-friendly and probably most applicable to sports. The challenge with the models, if you do buy them and do use them, you need to invest heavily in educating your people around sleep and performance. And it's like any sort of model. If you put junk in, you get junk out. So you have to be familiar with the model, familiar with the science, and use it appropriately to either retrospectively kind of look at the data or predictively look at the data. And so I would actually recommend for people to go to somebody who can actually model it for you, because by the time it kind of takes you to get really off with the model and invest time in it and get trained up, you know, we get such turnover in businesses and organizations, even in elite athletics, that the person's moved on and then all that knowledge is gone with them. So it's not very intuitive to just pick up and learn like within an hour or half an hour. So you're probably best off using an external consultant to run the modeling for you, which will probably work out cheaper in the long run.
Mm-hmm. So how does that, so what kind of hardware are we using to get the information that we need to run the model?
Yeah, so you can do it in a couple of ways. You don't need any hardware as such. You can just have the model and you can just base it off kind of what you know happens within your team or group of athletes. And you can say, look, we know that every night the guys go to bed at 11 because they're self-reported, which obviously isn't great. Or we just know on average this is what happens. And so you can kind of get a feel for what's happening with the model with that. But as you kind of input more objective data from different hardware sources, the more confidence you're going to have within the data from the modeling. With the SAFETY model, for example, you can have an integrated system from hardware, from a wrist activity monitor. And most people would know this as like a Fitbit. But the company who has the SAFETY model also has a wrist-worn device called a ReadyBand, which some people may be familiar with, which gets used in elite sports. It's been used by the Seattle Seahawks, the Vancouver Canucks, the New York Giants, and the Wallabies, the Australian rugby team, are currently using it. We've used it in Western Force Rugby. We've used it at the AIS. We've used it in women's basketball. And it's also been used in a whole host of industrial applications. Now, the benefit about that watch to ready band, that actually talks to the model and gives you a real-time score of actually what's happening in terms of effectiveness. So the individual wearer can look at it and say, you know, I'm at X percent performance, and they can actually use it then to predict out what they're going to be like in 10 hours. But more importantly, the athletic staff or the coach can log into the system that's cloud-based and look at the whole team. And then they can kind of, you know, ebb and flow and adapt the training as they need to over time. So if they do land in an area, let's say they travel from Perth to Johannesburg, the coach can just tap into the system and really see who's at risk or who's at low effectiveness and what times they should be training at and what times they should be avoiding training at for that local time zone.
So what are the, why is this model the most appropriate to sport? What does it give or doesn't give that other models may or may not?
Yeah, so a lot of the models have been developed for rolling stock maintenance or rail, or if they've been developed specifically for aviation. The safety model was developed with a very kind of military flavor, right? So it makes it more apt to use in sport, but also the outputs are more transferable to sport. Now, in the model itself, when you put in the parameters and you run it out, it gives you this kind of a curve and you can see it oscillating. The best thing about this is the score that it outputs runs on a scale of 0 to 100%. If we break those down and say, well, what does that actually mean? There's been some work done on the model which has been published that shows that at certain percentages, you can equate this to blood alcohol concentration or equivalency. And so many people will be familiar with that. You know, we don't drive drunk because we know that our reaction time is impaired and we can't really concentrate on a task at that time. And therefore, we know if we're over a certain level, like 0.05, we're basically unfit to drive that vehicle. Within the model, we know that at 77%, that equates to 0.05%. So if you are using the model and you can identify that on Friday at 4 o'clock in Sydney, all the team are going to be at 86%. But we know now it's pretty low. And then you look at it and you go at 10 o'clock at night, it's going to be at 76%. Well, now we know that at 76% at 10 o'clock at night on a Friday night, that the team is going to be basically operating reaction time or cognitive performance the same as if they were intoxicated to 0.05%. And they have that increase in reaction time or reduction in performance. And then if we want to look at it at a different level, 70% in the model is the equivalent of 0.08% as well. And so we can start kind of quantifying the effect on our reaction time and cognitive performance. So it's really good at kind of giving us real measures that we can easily interpret and apply across the whole team or even to specific individuals who may be at risk. Because when we use the hardware, the watch, we can really identify the person that may be at risk, and we can also look at the team as well. So we can look at the organizational and the individual. And with the watch integration as well, we can start looking at specific people and specific strategies to improve their sleep.
So to me, this seems like quite obvious why people would use it. So why aren't people using it in sport?
I think a couple of things. One is that the Ready Band had never been peer-reviewed and published in terms of its validity. I'm happy to say, Rob, that about 4 months ago, we had that paper accepted and it's now published in Sleep and Biological Rhythms, the journal. And so the device has now been validated. The biomathematical modeling has been well validated in industry, such as shift work in aviation and military, as I spoke about, but it's never been used in sport. Now, we've used it in a paper that's currently in review, and we're hoping that that sort of gets up. But I think one has been the lack of validation. And secondly, I think no one's really just taken the plunge and used it and tried to communicate it. It's been heavily used in shift work, but not in sports. And when people see it from sports, they're quite impressed with it and are actually willing to try it and use it. And I think from if you look at some of the work that David Martin did at the AIS, and he speaks about this really well. He's in the US now, Philadelphia, the basketball team there. He speaks about the communication with coaches as a scientist. And this is a great tool because it's easy to use. It crosses over, it gives you that effectiveness score, and you can really start communicating with coaches and athletic staff about how this is going to affect directly to performance at a specific time.
Do you think it's bordering on the, and not saying this is a good or bad thing, do you think it's bordering on the kind of big brother scenario, which people are quite wary of with elite athletes?
The modelling itself, as a safety model for biomathematical modelling, does not have a Big Brother element on it, because you can do that independently and you can just drag in data de-identified to give you average scores. So you could drag in 30 people's data and then, 3-0, not dirty, my accent here, sorry. I should say 33 people's data, just to make it even harder. And you can bring in that data, de-identify and look at it that way. The other thing as well is, from a Big Brother perspective and sort of privacy, there is levels of authority that we can set in the back of the system where only certain people can look at it. So the data doesn't always have to be shown and you don't actually know who has to have it. But I'll tell you what is very interesting, Rob, and I have, probably done, I'd say, somewhere in the magnitude of 3,000 to 4,000 assessments of athletes and industry workers, probably even more. I think I've come across maybe 5 people who didn't want someone to look at their data. That's all. Because most people are like, oh, this is really cool. If I've got a problem, I want my boss to know about. We've had people who are not very good at shift work, or people who had struggled traveling when they're traveling Super Rugby. And now they had an objective data set to bring to the coach or bring to the athletic staff to actually look for help, or to the GP or the team doctor to say, look, every time I travel east, this is what happens. So now the doctor can look at that and say, okay, I'm going to give you temazepam. We're going to have a caffeine strategy, X, Y, and Z, whatever it might be. And most people are very, very, willing to share it. And if they're not, we can just turn that level of authority off.
So is there anything deeper come from these assessments? I know we spoke last week about sleep disorders. Is this something that, using this kind of tech hardware and the model itself, that can detect them types of issues?
Yeah, for sure. We've used this in elite sports in conjunction with validated sleep questionnaires. Now, if you look at the range on assessing sleep and sleep disorders, you've got the top level PSG, polysomnography and laboratory, and then right down to kind of self-reported. And obviously, the more you go towards the lab, the better it is. But it's not always kind of, I suppose, appropriate or ecologically valid to do those things. So this actigraphy device is a nice kind of in-between step. And this allows you to pick up on longitudinal issues with people. So the person can wear the watch, they recharge the watch themselves. It doesn't need anybody to get in there and download the data. It automatically does it. It syncs to the person's phone. It uploads every time the person wants to push that data to the cloud. And so as a scientist remotely, or as an athletic staff, or whatever it may be, we can look at the data and the patterns in conjunction with the validated sleep disorder questions, in conjunction with the anthropometric data, and even just chatting to the individual themselves, and we can start identifying possible sleep disorders. And then we can refer them on for further assessment with a sleep physician, or we can do some what I would call applied sleep hygiene practices. So just things about, how do we manage sleep on a day-to-day basis? How do we make people relax before sleep? How do we use caffeine? How do we not use caffeine? Alcohol? How do we travel? And there's a whole host of low-hanging fruit there that we can just hit straight away.
So what is the sleep disorder manifesting itself as? Like, what's actually happening, why these people can't sleep? I know we chatted about a few things with regards to twitchy legs.
Yeah, so sleep disorders is a generic term that pertains to over 80 sleep disorders that's currently identified by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. A lot of people go, 80? Yeah, it is actually that many, and it's broken down to subcategories. Most people will be familiar with probably obstructive sleep apnea or snoring, which is one of the sleep-related breathing disorders. And so we've completed some work with the Western Force where we took 25 of those guys, brought them into the sleep laboratory, which is a fairly big task. They all slept in the lab overnight. We wired them up with polysomnography, PSG, which is the gold standard for assessing sleep disorders. And then we wanted to look and see how many of these guys maybe have had sleep disorders. And this paper is currently in review. So sleep disorders are obviously, as they say, it's a disorder of sleep and it's going to affect sleep. So it's an enabling factor to getting good night's sleep. So if they have a sleep disorder, it's obviously going to affect their sleep, therefore they don't get enough sleep, therefore they feel tired the next day, which may affect their performance and their mood. and in the long term, it may affect their health. Now, what we found, what we did in Super Rugby, is that approximately 24% of those guys had obstructive sleep apnea, and approximately 12% of those guys had what's called periodic leg movement disorder. Now, obstructive sleep apnea, these guys had mild obstructive sleep apnea, so basically their oxygen saturation levels were dropping overnight. They weren't getting enough oxygen into the body, therefore it will cause a micro arousal in the brain, and it will have these like mini awakenings that which they may not even remember. But over time, that was actually affecting their sleep. So they might have anywhere between 5 and 10 of these events in an hour. And then sort of over an 8-hour period, that's a lot of events. And that all adds up to time awake. With the periodic leg movement disorder, this is characterized by movement in the lower limbs, so around the fibula and tibia, and the legs are kind of paddling back and forth. If you've ever seen a dog maybe asleep in your kitchen or the sitting room, and he's asleep, and you're all sitting there laughing at the dog because his legs are moving, and he thinks he's running, this is what we often see in people with periodic leg movement disorder as well. Now, obstructive sleep apnea can be fixed by a couple of different means. One is continuous positive airway pressure. So you wear this mask overnight that basically forces oxygen down into your system. But for some people in general population, it's just as the easiest solution is just to lose body weight. So body mass index is a great predictor of obstructive sleep apnea. For periodic leg movement disorder, on the obstructive sleep apnea as well, position of sleep as well. And many people out there may have a partner who snores when they're on their back. And obviously that position is part of it as well. And then for periodic leg movement disorder, we find that this is often linked to low iron levels. And for people here in hotter climates, it may be linked to a depletion of magnesium and electrolytes as well, which can affect that. So we have a lot of players reporting that it's actually worse during those times. Now, our study was actually completed in the middle of winter, in the off season, so they weren't actually experiencing those high levels, those high training loads or high performance levels in Super Rugby that they normally do. We were probably getting the best case scenario. It's also worth mentioning, Rob, as well, there's very little done on sleep disorders in elite athletes. Across most athletic groups, there's a couple of papers out of the NFL from a few years ago that used kind of cut down PSG or at home PSG. The same with ice hockey players in Scandinavia. And John Paul Kea from University of Queensland has done a level 2 study with some guys there in rugby league players. And interestingly, they found a link not between BMI and sleep disorders, but they found a link between body fat and sleep disorders. Because obviously rugby players are quite big, but they found actually a link between the body fat percentage and the prevalence of a sleep disorder.
Interesting. So when you mentioned level 2, so level 1's in the lab.
Yeah.
What's 2?
Oh, yeah. So I alluded to that a little bit earlier, that like PSG in the lab, polysomnography, and then you've got kind of actigraphy in the middle, and then at the lower end you have like questionnaires or self-reported. Between actigraphy and PSG, you kind of start losing channels as you come out of the lab. So you can do a home level 2 PSG, which is a cut-down version, so you don't have a camera. You know, you don't have a tech looking at the person whilst they're asleep. And that can be a problem if somebody's got something like REM behavior disorder or they're sleepwalking, because you don't have a record of that. And then as you go to level 3 and then level 4, you're constantly just cutting off those channels. So you may not have as many EEG markers or respiratory markers or movement markers. And that's all based on pretest probability. So if we looked at the actigraph data and we looked at some validated sleep questionnaires, we might say to an athlete, look, you're better off with a level 4 assessment at home where we just look at your respiratory flow and abdominal and thoracic movement. We're not really interested in your leg movement because you're not displaying any signs of leg movement from the questionnaires and the data. And so we'll just do this at home one. Or another athlete, we might be like, we have no idea what's going on here. We want to put them into the lab. And the reason sometimes we put people into the lab is because the long-term effects of those sleep disorders, and we know with a lot of the movement disorders, such as periodic leg movement disorder or REM behavior disorder, we know that in the long term, those people are more at risk of developing Parkinson's and dementia when they get older. So we need to try and, you know, control those things now, not just from an athletic performance standpoint, but from a long-term safeguarding of that person's health.
Just going to take a very quick break in the chat with Ian. Hope you're enjoying part one. So over in part two, we discuss more on caffeine and a little bit on sleep disorders. But just before we do get into part two, I want to say a big thanks to Fatigue Science for sponsoring this episode today. So if you've got this far in the episode, Ian kind of alluded to it, that Fatigue Science are the leaders when it comes to this type of biomathematical modeling. So there's not much more I need to say really on top of what the expert Ian has actually said in part one, apart from if you do want to get to know more about Fatigue Science, have a little look on the website at fatiguescience.com and follow him on Twitter at Fatigue Science. So the only couple of things that I would add on top of Ian's information that he delivered in part one with regards to the Ready Band from Fatigue Science is a couple of logistical things that I feel that Fatigue Science do really well. Firstly, open API for third-party software, AMS systems, etc. 30-day battery life and data syncs via Bluetooth to a central iPad or on a player's phone, which I know how important that logistical stuff is for people working in elite sport, and it's something that I think that Fatigue Science does really well. So thank you to them guys for sponsoring this episode. But over to part two with Ian, where he, as I said, discusses more about caffeine and sleep disorders. So I hope you get as much out of part two as you did in part one, and I'll speak to you soon. Okay, so one thing that you mentioned there was the use of caffeine, and congratulations on the acceptance of your paper the other day, which was quite timely.
Yeah, it was perfect.
So talk to us a little bit about your background in the use of caffeine in Super Rugby, and a little bit about the paper. That might be a good place to start, I guess.
Yeah, so this is one of my final chapter of my PhD, which was called Caffeine Use in Super Rugby Games and in a Super Rugby Game and its relationship to post-game sleep. So this was interesting because a couple of reasons. When I started undertaking my PhD sort of 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, I started looking at caffeine use in athletes and the effect on sleep. And Rob, I couldn't find anything. I found papers on the effect of caffeine on sort of physical performance during the day as an ergogenic aid. I found all these position statements. I couldn't find anything on the effect of sleep after a competition. And most of the literature was done, obviously, as you would expect, in things like military or in shift work or in laboratory conditions, but no one had really looked at, you know, sleep after a game in the field or the applied setting. So we basically took a home game here in Perth with Super Rugby team Western Force, and we had them wear these actigraphy devices, the Ready Band, which I discussed and which we validated for a week. So we had 3 nights on before the game, the night of the game, and 3 nights after the game. They wore this device. They filled in a number of these validated sleep questionnaires, kept sleep diaries, and so on. But what we were really interested to look at was not just the pre-game sleep, but it was the more on the night of the game. And so we also took or obtained saliva samples before the game, and we also obtained saliva samples after the game. And what was very interesting in this study was the game was played between 7 and 9 o'clock. And so we took the saliva samples at 5 in the evening before the game, and then again at 9:30 after the game. And what we found was compared to the nights leading up to the game, on the night of the game, players went to bed on average 3 hours later. So they were going to bed at approximately 2:30 in the morning compared to about, you know, 11:15 most nights. So there's significant delay in time of sleep onset. They had approximately 2 hours less sleep than, 1.5 hours less sleep than on other nights. And 4 players did not achieve any sleep after the game out of these 23 players. The caffeine concentrations from before the game to after the game substantially or significantly increased in 17 of the 23 players. And afterwards, we also observed a moderately associated relationship in sleep latency. And sleep latency is the time to fall asleep with the change in caffeine levels. We had a decrease in sleep efficiency, and we had a statistical trend, 0.06, just on the cusp of significance for a decrease in sleep duration on game night. So we know there's other factors here that contribute to this, such as the time of the game being in the evening, post-game media, post-game recovery, post-game hydration, post-game, you know, sort of nutrition. But we did find this, you know, association here with caffeine as well. So it's quite interesting.
So in terms of practical application, what would be your recommendations off the back of that, all that information?
So we did that study a couple of years ago, Rob, and then this year, just this season just finished up. We did some more work there with the Western Force in a quite large study of jet lag circumnavigating the globe, which we had an honor student, Tim Smitty's on, who he did a great job on that project. And we actually took this data and applied a caffeine strategy for this year. One of the things I was very surprised at when we did this paper originally or conducted it was that a lot of athletes did not realize that pre-workout had caffeine. A lot of athletes did not realize that no-dose tablets or alertness tablets from the chemist had caffeine. And so there was a little bit of education here around educating the players and the athletic staff about sources of caffeine. We also educated the players and the staff around the pharmacokinetics of caffeine and how caffeine basically affected sleep. And for your listeners today, on average, if you consume caffeine, it would peak in the system roughly 60 minutes later. So if you take caffeine at 5 in the evening, it peaks in the system at 6 o'clock. The half-life of caffeine is 4 hours, so you basically shouldn't be trying to go to bed until about 10 o'clock at night, because if you go before that, you're basically going to have the alerting effects of the caffeine. And so many people were kind of naive to the effects of caffeine and pharmacokinetics. So what we did this year was put a caffeine strategy in place with the athletic staff, and we also strategically wrote the doses of pre-workout and educated guys on pre-game caffeine consumption as well, so the morning of the game, not to be having 4 or 5 lattes and so on. Interesting enough, which we weren't able to draw any sort of scientific relationship with, and the literature doesn't even support this, is that many players, when they start going to a caffeine strategy, here in Australia in the heat, reported less cramping, which is quite interesting. So once it starts strategically using caffeine at certain times, had less cramping. And some players actually just completely avoided caffeine and did not cramp during a game. Whereas the season before that, some players were cramping at about the 60-minute mark, which would coincide with roughly about an hour after they consumed a pre-workout. And just to give you an idea, Rob, some guys were consuming pre-workout, and it says take one scoop. And as we know, as men, a lot of us do this. One scoop is good. Three scoops is better. And so when we back calculate that, it was approximately 12 espresso shots for some people before a game. Yeah, so it's quite significant.
Jeez. So if they're ramping the amount of caffeine up, the half-life is still going to be the same so far.
Yeah, it's just a crash. It's going to be worse. You want to keep delaying the time of sleep onset. So if you look at here, the guys weren't going to bed till 2:30 in the morning. And that's got a significant standard deviation of some people not going to bed till, like, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning. And remember, 4 of these players couldn't even sleep. Now, most times when you do applied studies, people will go and kind of feed you a bit of lies afterwards. These 4 guys, when I approached them, just said, yeah, I didn't sleep. And they self-reported the fact that they didn't sleep in their sleep diaries as well, because they're just too kind of hyped up after the game. From a contact game such as rugby, the excess caffeine, you know, the whole kind of thing of playing in front of a crowd of 20,000 people, bright lights, you know, being pumped up, it's very, very difficult for them to kind of wind down after the game. And that's another thing we did in the broader strategy with the Super Rugby team, was we looked at strategies to relax people after a game. And this is something I often do with fighters as well, because they're quite hyped up after training or a fight.
So this links in nicely with the next topic, which was sleep banking. That strategy used in cases like this where people couldn't sleep after the game, so they'd bank it before knowing that they were going to have a horrendous sleep after the game?
Yeah, so sleep banking or sleep optimization often gets a fair bit of debate in the scientific community. Some people say you can do it, some people say you can't. But really, if you know you're going to encounter a period of low sleep or lack of sleep, well, then you should kind of optimize or maximize your sleep in those days leading into it. And, you know, we can get into the weeds of that, but really it's just about having good sleep before you go to that period of lack of sleep. This is done a lot in military. There was a paper a couple of years ago by a guy called Yarnell, which looked at special forces operatives and how they would actually sleep prior to a mission, and actually helped them kind of negate the negative effects of sleep for up to maybe the first 72 hours. What was happening in this team, Rob, is that combined with the travel interstate across Australia, and for those listeners, it's like, it's 5 hours for us to fly from Perth on the West Coast and the East Coast. So even a domestic game here in Australia is like an international game in Europe. And then we had the guys flying to Johannesburg and then to South America and then to Japan. So, you know, and Super Rugby gets called a domestic competition, but they actually travel more than the international rugby teams. It's quite bizarre. And so these guys were actually naturally using sleep banking in their strategies every week, where on sort of Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then Friday, they were increasing their sleep progressively each night before the game. They would crash after the game, and then they would kind of have this ramp up again of sleep duration. Now, that was not a strategy that was agreed upon. That was a strategy that actually just occurred as a fact of the training sessions. And this is where we come back to the first point on biomathematical modeling. When we started inputting the time of day of the training sessions, we actually identified that on Monday and Tuesday, this was actually negatively affecting sleep. And so to play a game on a Saturday night, they don't sleep very well, maybe 4 to 5 hours sleep, then they might get 7 hours sleep on Sunday, but then they're in at like 7 o'clock on a Monday morning. So when we started looking at the biomathematical modeling and pumping that data in, we start identifying and saying, look, on a Monday morning, when you get these guys in at 7:30, yeah, sure, you want to get them in, you want to get them going, but they're operating at like 72%. So for the first 4 hours, you're just killing them and you're not getting any real engagement. So you're better off delaying your training times to maybe 8:30 or 9:00. And so when we start doing that, we start having, you know, better effectiveness. And it's quite interesting, Rob, I'm not saying there's a relationship here, but last year with the Western Force under the leadership of Dave Wessels and some of this stuff we were doing in conjunction with other strategies, it's arguably one of the best seasons the Western Force have had from implementing some of these changes around training times, preparation for games, and, you know, not just sleep banking, but sleep optimization of every night leading into a game. And then also strategically how they would sleep bank on a plane when they were getting into a new time zone. And on that point as well, when you cross to a new time zone, it takes on average 1 day to get used to that time zone. So if you fly from the UK to Perth, it's an 8-hour time difference. It should take about 8 days. We had that down to 24 hours. So we were getting players synchronizing to the new time zone within 24 hours using low-level sleep medication, controlling light and dark cycles, optimization of sleep environments, and educating the guys on when and when not to sleep, and then working with the athletic staff to determine training times to maximize performance.
So I'm traveling to Brisbane in 8 days, bring it back so it doesn't look so selfish that I want some advice. But what would be the strategy that you would employ 8 days out from a trip that's going to probably take 26 hours to Brisbane via Dubai?
Yeah, so without getting into the weeds of it, the first thing I'd start saying to you is if you're traveling via Dubai to Brisbane, you're traveling in an eastwardly direction, it's going to be actually harder for you to adapt to a new time zone coming this way as it is going back. So straight away, you're up against it. The next thing I'd ask is, are you flying business class or economy? So that would... You don't have to tell people that.
By that last is only one option.
First class. Because that will obviously affect the strategy as well, because we know that when we fly business class or first class for some teams, we have a better chance of getting some sleep. And so what I try to do, Rob, for you prior to going, I would start trying to get you onto the sleep cycle or the light and dark cycle of Australia before you go. But more importantly, as you travel, I would identify based upon your itinerary when you're leaving the UK and when you're arriving in Brisbane about the day before the travel, how you should sleep on the plane, what you should do in Dubai, and then more importantly, when you land in Brisbane, what you should do. Because even though we can do all that preparation beforehand and control light and dark cycles through use of sunglasses and strategic napping and avoidance of caffeine, I find that the first 24 hours in a location is key. And sometimes you're just going to have to kind of have a bad day when you get somewhere and just struggle through it. And that can be the best thing to synchronize you, as opposed to going to bed at 12 o'clock when you land somewhere. So what I'm trying to do is advance your cycle, because we're obviously ahead in Australia. So I'm trying to advance you maybe an hour a day if I can. That's not always appropriate. So I'll be trying to, get you onto that time zone as soon as possible. But to answer that question, I would have to look at your travel times, stopovers, and all of those things. And I also have to ask you, when do you want to be alert when you get to Brisbane? Are you coming here for a holiday? Are you coming for a meeting? Are you coming here to do a sales pitch? Are you coming here to record a podcast? What sort of effectiveness do you want to be at? And that is, for me, is the key, because we want to optimize and maximize your performance for a certain time when you land here.
Mm-hmm. We're definitely flying economy, just to put that out there. It's not business, unfortunately.
but if you want to send me your stuff, Rob, afterwards, I can send you back a strategy.
That'd be different.
24 hours, 36 hours.
No, that'd be class, mate. I mean, Shona, when I interviewed Shona, it was ironically a couple of days before I flew to Australia 2 years ago, and she mentioned an app. I don't know. Obviously, N-Tren. It's not.
Is it N-Tren?
I can't remember. I'll dig it out anyway and put a link. Obviously, it's not going to be as comprehensive as obviously speaking to you about it. But yeah, I'll dig it out and I'll link that and I'll see if the app's still going.
Now, also, Rob, in conjunction with this, if your listeners want to go to my website, sleepforperformance.com.au, they can actually download a free book, a short ebook, it's 30 odd pages, which is called Managing Sleep and Jet Lag for Optimal Performance. And I've co-authored that short book with Dr. John Caldwell, who was an experimental psychologist with NASA and the US Air Force for nearly 40 years he's worked in this field. And so that's a free little book there that people can get. It's got some links to some stuff. And it's got some background information. So people can go and freely download that book off my website and use that. But if you want to send me your info, I'll put together a small quick jet lag plan for you with some principles to follow in the next 24 hours.
Oh, sweet. That'd be class, mate. So what's the website again?
Sleep, S-L-E-E-P, the number 4, performance.com.au. And you can go there and you can download, you can read my blogs, you can get links to my podcast, Sleep for Performance Radio, where I interview athletes, coaches, scientists, industry people. There's a whole host of people there. And I've just started launching a series of research podcasts which communicate my research findings as well. So they're short little ones you can get, and they're in between each guest. And they're all at that website there as well. And you can get links to my research papers. You can get links there to any media appearances I've done on TV or radio, and all those links are there as well.
Superb. Well, before I let you go, last question is a couple of books that have influenced you the most, life, study, whatever it may be.
Yes, there's two books recently. Actually, since we spoke previously, there's more books that I've gone deep into. So recently, Viktor Frankl, A Man's Search for Meaning, has been a book that just absolutely blew me away. And I really enjoyed that. It's hard to enjoy the book, but I did enjoy it. I suppose at times you cringe reading it, but I think it's a must reading for anybody. And if you're going through a crisis or a difficult time, I read it sort of in the last year of my PhD, being all sorry for myself. And I read that and I was like, whoa, I have nothing to complain about. and most recently, I've been reading, I finished a book on Theodore Roosevelt, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, which is written by an author called Edmund Morris. And it's one of three books on Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt was an amazing character. If you actually go to the History on Fire podcast with Daniele Bolelli, he's got three episodes on Teddy Roosevelt. And it was those episodes that got me into reading more about him. You know, he was obviously the president of the United States. He was a Freemason. He had a cattle ranch. He was the commissioner of the police force at one stage. He used to box. He was basically like an MMA athlete. He was a judo brown belt. he was famous for in the Oval Office sparring with members of the cabinet at lunchtime. He also went and fought in Cuba, and he resigned as the assistant secretary for the Navy and went and fought in Cuba. I don't think you'll see too many politicians doing that today. But when you read this book, it doesn't even read like a history book. It reads like this kind of, I don't know, superhero spy. It's like this epic novel on its journey, and the way it's written is brilliant. So that's been really good. And then last week I picked up a copy of a book called Grant, about Ulysses S. Grant, written by a guy called Ron Chernow. And that's only like 1,100 pages long. And it's given me, I think I nearly broke my wrist trying to hold it up. But that's an awesome book as well. And that just starts off with Ulysses S. Grant growing up. Another very, very interesting character. That's a great book. I can't put that down. And I've also been getting into a guy called Jordan B. Peterson, which obviously links back to the meaning of life stuff with Viktor Frankl. I've been listening to his book on audio called 12 Rules for Life. And Jordan Peterson, a very polarizing character in the media. Some people like him, some people hate him. But I think if you listen to what he says and kind of get into him, he's an interesting character from Canada. So he's an interesting character from an audiobook perspective to listen to.
Superb. Well, thank you for that. But no, I'll put all the links on the website and people can get over to your page, over to your website, looking at podcasts and the blog and stuff, and then obviously links to the books. So Ian, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. And we'll chat afterwards. But yeah, thanks again for giving me time.
No worries, Rob.
Thanks, mate. Speak to you soon. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast. Hope you enjoyed the chat with Ian. Massive thanks to Ian for giving up his time and for also helping me with my trip to Brisbane, which I hopefully have come back in one piece because I'm recording this before I went, but it's actually going to go out after I come back, which is a little bit weird. But thank you very much to the guys at Fatigue Science, Val Performance and Force Dex for sponsoring this episode today. So as always, any feedback on the episode, on the podcast as a whole, is always more than welcome. So I've got some great guests coming up over the next couple of weeks from the world of track and field, from rugby, and some big guys, very big guys, from the world of football or soccer. So thanks for tuning in again, and I will chat to you next week.